Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
We will be in 2 Samuel chapter 4 this evening, 2 Samuel chapter 4. Briefly, we need to remember where we are when we turn to chapter 4. Verse 1 of chapter 3 explains there is a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And so here you have this time. Now David's house is growing stronger each day. And as David's house goes stronger, Saul's house becomes weaker. And the strength in Saul's house, we're told in verse 6 of chapter 3, is that while this war was going on between Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. So even as Saul's house is getting weaker and weaker, Abner within Saul's house is getting stronger and stronger. But the last time we got together, Abner was murdered by Joab for revenge of his brother Asahel. And this comes back to Abner's words in chapter 2, verse 26, where Abner told and called to Joab, and he said, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know the end will be bitter? How long will it be before I tell your people to turn from the pursuit of their brothers? Never a true statement, shall the sword devour forever. And within these opening chapters of 2 Samuel, that is exactly what is happening. The sword is endless, continually marked with death. Chapter 1, the Amalekite coming and boasting of killing Saul, putting Saul to death and Jonathan's death, and boasting in and gloating in that, but then David puts him to death. Chapter 2, another chapter marked with more bloodshed with the pool of Gibeon. Remember the 12 verses 12. 20 of David's servants died that day, and 360 of Abner's servants died as well. Chapter 3 starts and says there's a long war between the two houses. And then Joab murders Abner. Shall the sword devour forever? Back to Abner's words. The end is bitter. And so too we see yet another chapter. But within all of this, we need to be reminded that this is all happening within one nation. As Abner says, shall they pursue brothers? This internal turmoil within the nation has devastating effects. I think we'll note, if we ever get there, to 1 and 2 Kings of the northern and southern kingdoms. I think they still have unhealed wounds. But chapter 4, we turn and yet again, another chapter of more bloodshed, another murder, another beheading. So let's look at chapter 4. The first thing we see is the weak house of Saul, verses 1 to 4. When Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, his courage failed, and all Israel was dismayed. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of one was Benah, and the name of the other was Rechab, sons of Rimeon, a man of Benjamin of Beeroth, for Beeroth also is counted part of Benjamin. And the Beerothites fled to Githam, and have been sojourners there to this day. The death of Abner's news brought discouragement. The courage failed. The Hebrews translates more not that his courage fails, but his hand failed. You know, we have that he gave into my hand. The Lord has given him into my hands. But now, Ish-bosheth's courage has failed. The puppet who was controlled by Abner, the puppet master, has now lost the puppet master. He is no longer useful. The problem with being a pawn in the game of chess is that you'll be used just like a pawn in the game of chess. But not only this news hit Ish-bosheth hard, But also Israel, the northern kingdom, was dismayed, shocked, placed a lot of trust in Abner. Abner the strong, the person who sought to be able to take things into his own hands. But finally, everything crumbled when he passed away. Now, before America fled and became their own nation, England was actually a republic. England was a republic from 1649. After the execution of King Charles I, England became a republic. And they moved underneath the Parliament, underneath Oliver Cromwell, who was made the Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of England, Scotland, and Ireland. And this went just over a decade. However, after Oliver Cromwell died, his son Richard took over. But he was not the military commander that his father was. He wasn't as good at all this. And finally, in 1659, the Commonwealth was dissolved. The monarch was reestablished once again. But all this hung upon Oliver Cromwell's shoulders. When he passed away, so too did the Republic. And so too, like the Republic of England, Abner's plan that he'd started in chapter 2, that if I was to make Ishbosheth king, that maybe I could have this power. Maybe I can use Ishbosheth. But then Abner died. His plan failed, and so too Ishbosheth is then left, not knowing what to do. But these ripples shock through the whole of the nation of Israel. They're already getting weaker and weaker, we're told in chapter 3. Abner is the main source of strength for Saul's household. But now, where's their strength gone? And the reality of this situation, it's not merely that you are weaker and weaker. Eventually, the bigger fish start to eat the smaller fish. And this becomes a life and death. Your family is in danger. But yet, then we're told about these two men. There's a lot of words given in these couple of verses about these two brothers. And that means it's very important. Here we see their rank. They're captain of raiding bands. This would have been Saul's army, military leaders that would go in and lead a raid. They would go into a place, and we'll see that further down. We learn about their names. Banah, the older, and then Rechab, the younger. But later, it's flipped around. Most likely, Rechab is the leader. And then we learn about their father, the son of Rimmon, and also their tribe, from the tribe of Benjamin. Now, Rimmon is important because we go back to Judges chapter 20, verse 21, and this has come up time and time again as we've gone through 1 Samuel. But Israel had turned into Sodom and Gomorrah. Israel had turned into just like the other nations, and within the tribe of Benjamin. And within this phrase comes up in these two chapters. Judges chapter 20, verse 5 and 6 explains the real leaders of Gilboa rose up against me and surrounded me. This man is explaining what's happened to him around the house by night. Again, you remember to Sodom and Gomorrah, what happened to the two angels there. The whole city comes and surrounds them by night. And they meant to kill me. And they violated my concubine. And she is dead. So what he does, he takes the concubine, cuts her to pieces, sends her throughout the country as the inheritance of Israel. For they had committed an abomination and an outrage. Now the refrain that comes up is not only they committed an abomination and an outrage, but it was done within the nation of Israel. It was done by Israelites. And this is the thing that comes up. What is normally done outside of the nation is now done within the nation. And here, Rimmon is a place. Benjamin is the tribe which commits this heinous crime. Benjamin's all within those chapters. But then what happens is some of them fled after all of Israel rose up to attack Benjamin. Some of them fled and they went to the rock of Rimmon. And so, too, this family probably descends from people that either fled there or have this connection there. This is why Sons of Ramon repeats several times. Might not only be that's their father's name, it might mean that's where they're from. And so, too, now you have these two leaders. They're military leaders on the raiding bands. And we'll see this also in 2 Samuel chapter 21. And this is where they're from. Not only they're called Ramon, but we learn about their hometown, Beroth. Beroth is counted a part of Benjamin, we're told. But in Joshua chapter 9, the Berothites left and go live in Gittim. So likely, what happened is in 2 Samuel chapter 21, we'll learn about what Saul does to the Gibeonites. But Beroth is close to this area as well. So most likely, Saul's army went in, took over Beroth, and this is where these raiding band captains set up, where they lived, as Saul wiped out the Gibeonites. And this is what you see here, the weak house. You go from Abner, a strong, able body in a military perspective, to be able to fight against Joab, as Abner's house goes strong within Saul's house. 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 38. David calls Abner a prince and a great man. This prince is this noble military title. But now what is left is these two raiders, these stealers from the rotten tribe of Benjamin. At the end of Judges, bringing back all these type of things. Strongly connected to the ones who fled, who lived in Ramon. As well, we see that they're connected to the tragedy of the Gibeonites. We could spell this out even more, but when you read this in Hebrew, it's actually quite an interesting paragraph. It makes it quite mysterious. What I've read before was from the ESV, but the New King James, I think, accurately captures this mystery within this chapter. What we're told is when Saul's son heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost heart. All Israel was troubled. And then they go, now Saul's son, and he goes into the two captains of the troops, Benon and Rechab. But then we get down to verse 4, and verse 4 explains, Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son whom was lame in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news of Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. And his nurse took him up and fled. And it happened, as she made haste to flee, that he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. So some translators insert, like the ESV does, insert Ishbosheth's name in verse 1. So it says, when Ishbosheth, Saul's son, and they make that connection that they're talking about Ishbosheth. But in the Hebrew, there's no, Ishbosheth's name doesn't appear there. All they were talking about is Saul's son. Saul's son heard about this. He was dismayed. Saul's son had two captains of the raiders. And then verse 4 begins and said, Jonathan, Saul's son. Saul's son, Jonathan, has a son called Mephibosheth. So we hear, this is the first we hear about Jonathan's children or child. We didn't know that he was married. We find out that he has one son. This event takes us all the way back to 1 Samuel, at the start of 2 Samuel. When we find out that Jonathan's son was 5 at the time Saul was killed. So during the time of 2 Samuel chapter 4, he's most likely around 12. We're told that David was king of Hebron for about 7 years. So most likely this is happening towards the end of that 7 years. So it puts him around the age of 12. And what we're told is, as they hear of this news, his nurse or the person, the guardian looking after him, Mephibosheth, they try and escape. It's not just king versus king, army versus army in this day and age, this time. The sword devours forever. A child of a king was a great danger. It's easier to wipe out a whole house when you wipe out the king than to leave descendants who with revenge will come back. But as he's running, he falls, becomes lame in 2 feet. And here we find out at the end of verse 4, his name is Mephibosheth. Now this is another poorly named child, the mouth of shame, the mouth of Baal. But here in the beginning of chapter 4, we see the author is writing and telling us about the house of Saul, that it became weaker and weaker. Now we know who he's talking about in verse 1, Ish-bosheth. But I think he leaves it out to connect all of this together. Ish-bosheth had no courage. Israel, the northern kingdom, is dismayed. These two captains are scoundrels. The next child in line has a disability. Now, we could have a president who sits in a wheelchair. We actually did have a president, 39 years old, Franklin Roosevelt, did Roosevelt in 1921. Served out the rest of his presidency, and I believe he actually got elected another time following this. But however, during this time, to have a disability would be completely different. To serve as a king, to carry out the duties of a king, to go and fight battles. Imagine trying to fight the Battle of Gilboa. There's not very clear paved roads like we would have today. There's no wheelchair. Wheels are invented, but wheels are not hollowed out. They're not light. They're used on big carts. The wheelchair was only invented in 1595. So this is just showing the weakness of Saul's house. But I also think we're told this as well as a foremention of what is to come. Because we're reminded again of David's covenant with Jonathan. But even David's covenant with Saul, that he said that he won't wipe out his house, which you see in chapter 9. But often, the Bible introduces people long before they step on, so you have a bit of an understanding when they appear, where they come from. This is what happens to Rebecca. She's mentioned in Genesis chapter 22, but then she does not appear until chapter 24. So what we see first up is Saul's house is crumbling, if not completely crumbled. Now we see the act of the cowardly brothers in verse 5 and 8. Now the sons of Ammon, the Beerothite, Rechab and Baanah, set out. At about the heat of the day, they came to the house of Ish-bosheth as he was taking his noonday rest. They came into the midst of the house, and as if to get wheat. But they stabbed him in the stomach. But Rechab and Baanah, his brother, escaped. When they came into the house, as he lay in his bedroom, they struck him and put him to death and beheaded him. They took his head and went by the way of the Arabah all night. Quite simply, they set out. They went to go find him. They come to the house. They stab him in the stomach. They escaped. But then we're given more information of what actually happened. When they came into the house, we're told in verse 7, as he was in his bed, in his bedroom, they struck him. They put him to death. But then they also beheaded him. They took his head by Arabah all night. So what you see here is they leave from Beeroth, go up to Mahanaim, travel all the way there, and then in the middle of the night they cross to go down to Hebron. Now what I think you see here is that they're not strong warriors. They came and tried to murder them and him in the middle of the night. I think it reminds you of Saul when he went to spy on David. Michal helps David escape and tells the messengers that David is sick. Saul's response in chapter 19, verse 15, is bring him up to me in bed that I may kill him. To be able to find David when he's weak, when he's sick, when he's still in his bed, and then to be able to kill him. And then what they do in verse 8, and they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. And they said to the king, "Here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord the king this day on Saul and on his offspring." So they bring Ishbosheth's head to David, a king. Now, I've never had a cat, but I'm told that cats often try and show their love and affection by bringing you dead things. To be able to put them on your porch and to be able to try and seek and find your love and attention by giving you a dead bird. And this is seemingly what it seems to appear like. Remember the Amalekite in chapter 1, he only merely brought a bracelet from Saul. But here, we see these two brothers bringing Ishbosheth's head. The Magi brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But here the brothers of Ramon bring a head. And we're told a little bit about why they did this, what they thought they would accomplish. Come before David the king. Here is the head of Ishbosheth. And they give three qualifications of who Ishbosheth is to David. Firstly, he's the son of Saul, David's enemy, as you remember. Not only that, your enemy, they exclaim, who sought your life. But I think the interesting thing about this is not the how they describe Ishbosheth, it's then what comes to follow. They say, "The Lord avenged my lord, the king, on this day, Saul and on his offspring." What they claim in this, that it was God's doing, God avenging Ishbosheth for David. Isn't it interesting that people can twist and distort theology to be able to suit their needs? They want, I think Dale Ralph Davis sums this up beautifully when he says, "And they came with blood on their hands, but theology on their lips, expecting that the latter will magically bleach the former. Murder always seems more pleasant when it's wrapped up in religious considerations. Banaz and Rechabs are still extant. Some are in our churches. Their mythology is unchanged. Use theology to cover sin and folly. For them, theology is not truth that lures us to worship God, but technique that enables us to justify ourselves." Here they come before David, and the Lord has avenged. The Lord has done this. Their actions of sin and murder, they then claim that it's the Lord's doing. That many people can use their lips to be able to justify their actions of sin, covering it up and saying it is good theology. Sadly, this is the case. This is exactly what the Pharisees did. They murdered Jesus, claiming, accusing him that he's committing blasphemy. Saul, after he dies, handed Nero because of the gospel, twisted and distorted. Church history is riddled with people with poor theology, claiming to justify their sinful hearts, but using God as their means of these horrendous sins. To commit horrendous sins is rotten, to do it to fulfill your sinful desires. But I think to be able to do those and then claim that they're godly is even more horrendous. And then we see David's response to this, the righteous judgment, in verses 11 to 12. "But David answered Rechab and Banah, his brother, the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, 'As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, when one told me, behold, Saul is dead, and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth?" Remember that Abigail principle that we've brought up very frequently in 1 Samuel chapter 25. When David responds to Abigail's wise words of wisdom compared to Nabal the fool, David turns and says, "Blessed be your wisdom, blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me from this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand." That here Abigail is able to save David from this blood guilt from his hand, but also trying to take things into his own hands to seek salvation for himself. Later on in the chapter, David explains three things that he explains how God will deal with Nabal. And these three qualifications come up, how he's going to trust in God, what God can do. And he says that the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into battle and perish. Here's these three categories that David is trusting God to be able to deal with this situation. And we also see this affirmation that God has redeemed my life out of every adversity. David takes no credit for where he is today. It's only because of God's grace he is standing there before them. He knows that the years of wandering in the wilderness, been chased by Saul, is only because of the grace of God to be able to see him through. Even being turned away by the five lords of the Philistines, it's only by the grace of God. Proverbs 20, verse 22 says, Do not say, "I will repay evil." Wait for the Lord, and he will deliver you. Or Psalm 30. Verses 1 to 6, "Out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my pleas for mercy. If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? But with you there is forgiveness, that you may be feared. I wait for the Lord. My soul waits, and in his word I hope. My soul waits for the Lord, more than watchmen for the morning, more than watchmen for the morning." That here David sits and explains that he just waits for the Lord to be able to deal with his enemies. "Not to be repay evil for evil, shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that the end is bitter?" David has indeed waited throughout this time from chapter 16 when he's anointed as king. Discuss this, he possibly could be as young as 12 years old there. I think more like 16, 18. But he's then waited for 18 to 12 years. He's not in a haste to get rid of Ishbosheth. But he says, "God has redeemed my life out of every adversity." He has done it. Time and time again, when we're going through 1 Samuel and looking at the Psalms, often we would see this cry and plea for help, but then there's also this trust and this hope that God has already done what he had prayed. But in Psalm 52, when the Ziphites come and told Saul that David is hiding among them, he cries out, "Save me by your name and vindicate me by your might. O God, hear my prayer. Give ear to the words of my mouth." Again, save me, cry out. And here is a testimony that David in chapter 4 says, God has. He has delivered me. He has redeemed me, my life out of every adversity. The sons of Rimmon came in pride and arrogance, but David explains, the Lord lives. And he has done it. He has got me this far by grace. And it's by grace that he will call me home. And he returns back to the Amalekite in chapter 1. The Amalekite in chapter 1, remember who comes up? And he explains that Saul is dead. I killed him for you. He had fallen on his spear or his sword. I took care of him for you. David explains what he did in that situation. This Amalekite thought he was bringing him good news. But David explains that the news that he brought got him a reward. The reward that he got was death. How much more, he explains, back to those three principles, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come, or he will go down into battle and perish. You might argue that Saul did die in battle at the hands, not of the Amalekite, as you remember, by his own hands. But here the sons of Rimmon killed Ish-bosheth while he was sleeping, and David points out not only that he was sleeping, he was in his own house, defenseless. Verse 11, how much more when the wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed? Shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth? To be able to destroy you from the earth, Genesis 9:6, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. The reminder of the sanctity of life. We also need to be reminded of why Saul's kingdom was taken from his hands. Saul's kingdom was taken from his hands because he did not obey the voice of God. He did not fulfill what God had commanded him to do. He did what was right in his own eyes. In chapter 15 of 1 Samuel, remember, he's instructed to be able to wipe out the Amalekites. But he did not listen. He partially did it, thinking that that's all he needed to do. But here, now you have David in a similar situation. How is David going to respond to this case? We see in verse 12. And David commanded his young men that they killed them and cut off their hands and feet and hang them outside the pool of Hebron. But they took the head of Ish-bosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron. We actually find out in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 22 to 23, and if a man had committed a crime punishable by death, that he is to be put to death, and you hang him on a tree. Again, they've come and they've confessed right before David and told them what they've done. They've got the evidence within their hands, the blood on their hands of Ish-bosheth's blood. And you're to put him to death. You're to hang him on a tree. Explain that his body shall not remain all night on the tree, but you shall bury him the same day. For a hanged man is cursed by God. So here you have, in the first three, four chapters, you see the blood guilt, the blood that is shed of these people trying to establish David's kingdom. Man seeks to be able to carry it out and find their own way. Paul explains in Romans 3, and why not do evil that good may come? Do evil that good may come. And here's their philosophy. All these men, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, now chapter 4. All of them are fueled by men seeking to do what is right in their own eyes to be able to establish David as king or themselves as king. Again, Dale Ralph Davis summarizes these chapters. No power can overcome the kingdom in chapter 2. No folly can thwart the kingdom, chapter 3. No injustice can establish the kingdom in chapter 4. You have each man, Abner, the man, the Amalekite, seeking to be able to find favor in the sight of David. Then Abner, trying to establish the kingdom by putting Ish-bosheth on the throne. Joab coming in, trying to establish his own name to revenge his own house. No injustice in Benah or Rechab. Yet David is quite different. Quite different from Saul, quite different from all these men. He seeks God's power, not his own. He seeks God's timing and waiting patiently for God to be able to carry out what he has promised. Not to be able to take salvation into his own hands. To seek God's wisdom. Not the wisdom of those around him. Not what is wise in his own eyes. What is wise is to wipe out Ishbosheth. To be able to become king of Israel. And also to seek God's justice. Seeking out to be able to carry out the righteous law of God. But Christ's kingdom is far greater. In this situation, what a difference it makes when Banah and Rachab come before the king and the king says that I'll be the one that's cursed and hung on a tree. Paul in Galatians 3 explains in verses 10 to 14, "For all who rely on works under law are under a curse, for it is written, 'Cursed be anyone who does not abide by the things written in the book of the law and not do them.' Now it is evident that no one is justified before God by the law, for the righteous shall live by faith. But the law is not faith. Rather, the one who does them shall live by them. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, 'Cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree.' So that in Jesus Christ, Christ Jesus, the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles, so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith." Or to put it another way, in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, "For our sake, he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." All of these things are true. God's power, God's timing, God's wisdom, God's justice. But how the tables are turned, because Christ, the sinless man, then takes on our sin to be able to fulfill the law for us.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America, located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.